afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. I appreciate it. Today, it's the latest installment in our series of conversations with the candidates, in which I'm speaking with folks who are running in the primaries that take place on May 14th. My guest today is Baltimore City Council President Nick Mosby. He was first elected to the City Council in 2011, where he served for nearly 5 years. In 2016, he ran for mayor of Baltimore, and he dropped out of the race a week before that primary. In 2017, Mr. Mosby applied to the Democratic Central Committee to complete the term of Catherine Pugh in the Maryland Senate when she was elected mayor. The committee chose another candidate, Delegate Barbara Robinson, but Mr. Mosby was appointed to complete Robinson's term in the House of Delegates. In 2020, Mr. Mosby was elected president of the Baltimore City Council, and he is standing for re-election to a second term in this year's primary. Nick Mosby is 46 years old. He was born and raised in Baltimore. He's a graduate of Poly High School and Tuskegee University, where he earned an engineering degree. He is the father of two school-aged children. He is one of four candidates in the Democratic primary field, a field which includes Councilman Zeke Cohen and former Councilwoman Shannon Sneed. Nick Mosby joins me in Studio A. You are welcome to join us as well. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org. Mr. Council President, welcome back.
Thanks for having me. Just two quick corrections. Okay. I'm 45.
45.
Birthday just took place, yes. And it took place in 2016. The transition or process to try to go to Annapolis.
2016.
Yeah, right.
Not 2017.
It's right at the end.
In December.
Yeah,
right,
governor waited 30 days to take the recommendation, and I went in 30 days late to that session in 2017.
All right. Well, I'm glad to be corrected on that. We want to get the details right. We want to talk about a lot of details, about a lot of stuff today. We have the hour. But, you know, you've had a very tumultuous few months, I mean, even few years, the last couple of years to be sure, with the trial of your former wife, who was found guilty on three of the four counts she was charged with. What have you learned? How have you processed all of what's happened to you in these last many months?
Well, you know, as a leader in the city, but more importantly, as a father, the reality is, you know, challenges and adversity come your way. And, you know, one, you have to still take care of your responsibilities. You know, that's why, you know, through these years, you know, I've showed up. I think that when folks see, like, look at the Board of Estimates today, we took about 3 hours to conclude it because of the level of dialogue, discourse, and detail that we get into. I think when folks have seen me perform and do my job, whether on the Board of Estimates or just professionalizing the council in the way that we've been able to do, that is what really sticks out. And, you know, I think as a mentor, role model, a leader to my young daughters, it's really showing them, you know, because they've been front seat with it just as much. That when times get tough, you still have to take care of responsibilities. You still have to continue to do your due diligence and show up every single day. And that's why I think ultimately, you know, when I decided to run, that I think the voters will definitely see through. You know, they'll see through an administration that I've been able to carry that has done everything from bringing local control back to the city of Baltimore, the first time since of the police department, the first time since the Civil War. We're the only jurisdiction in the state that didn't have it, things like the Pimlico win that we just had and my fight in Annapolis to ensure that the Preakness stayed in the city of Baltimore, all the way to, you know, policy decisions. You know, this is the first time in 120 years where the city council has been so engaged on the budget, not just being able to cut from the budget, but also redirect spending in the budget and building up the capacity and the subject matter expertise in the office to do so, to leverage in a very open and transparent process with redistricting. So, you know, in the past 3 years, it has not been ideal from a personal life perspective. I think professionally, when it came time to do really, really important things of trying to move our city forward, you know, I think that through my leadership, this council has stepped up. And I think that has always been indicative of the job that I've done and my experience and my successes prove that. I think that's what sets me apart from anybody else who's jumped in this race.
When it comes to responsibility, something that's been in the news just these last couple of days. Last Friday, Judge Lawrence Fletcher Hill overturned a ruling by the Ethics Compliance Board saying that the names of the people who donated to your legal defense fund do not have to be revealed. That document can continue to be redacted. What is the public interest in keeping those names secret?
I don't really know. I mean, I'm supportive of releasing the names, and I've been very open and transparent. We had nothing to do with that process. The investigation of what the ethics department did was what it was. You saw the result of it. I had to disclose to everybody that there was a fund set up in the name of my wife and myself. I did that. We had to send back all monies received. We didn't receive a penny from it. I think it only raised like $14,000. And we had to ask the folks that set it up to dissolve it. I think that was the ruling from an ethics perspective. So, you know, whoever donated, I think folks donated all the way from $1 up to a couple $1,000s.
Was there any promise made to any of the folks who donated?
Zero promises made.
That would not be made public?
Not by myself at all. Again, we had absolutely nothing to do with the process. We didn't ask the city to hold back the names. I really don't care. I was kind of happy to get the process over with. I was very transparent and open about it from the very beginning that it wasn't a process that we were running. It wasn't a process that we were leading, nor did we benefit from it at all. I mean, I would say that because of all the scrutiny of it, it probably really hurt. It didn't help as it relates to all the other things that were going on at the time. So,
because the board did back in 2022 did say that you failed to disclose the fund on your ethics report.
That's what I just said. They said that, I mean, but it was already publicly known. I mean, it's already been through the news. This is the first time I think that a trust fund.
But you also failed to disavow the fund. You didn't, the judge agreed with two of the three findings of the ethics board.
Well, the biggest finding that he threw out, which was really their case, was that we took money. The fund took money from controlled donors. That was the big thing. The other things of disclosing it on my disclosure, that could have happened in a cure process. So the ethics board could have come to me and said, "Hey, Nick, go and put this on your ethics form." They could have said, "Hey, Nick, write this letter to say that you disavow," and I would have done that. I think the process that we had to go through and really kind of just leading the public on to this process was ultimately killed when the judge made the decision that, hey, he didn't accept, this fund didn't accept any money from controlled donors. He didn't do anything that was
controlled unethical. Donors being donors who have business with the city.
Correct. So, right. So obviously, you know, from a conflict of interest
perspective. You had the option of doing those things without the ethics board, commanding you to, right?
Well, again, this is the first time this has ever happened. I don't know that there's any precedence. Again, I had no control of it. I wish that typically when processes happen like this and there is an investigation or there is a board that kind of sits, they'll say like, hey, this is how you cure this. So the way you cure it, council president, if we can find that you've really done anything wrong, you know, just put this on your disclosure. That way you publicly like tell folks that you did this, right? And then also adhere to maybe asking this entity that was founded to do these things. And I would have done that completely wholeheartedly. That wasn't the meat of the case. What they wanted to try to say was that I accepted funds from folks that were potentially doing business with the city, which weren't more than and far from inaccurate. And that's what the judge ultimately ruled. So, again, I think that it was a lot of media hoopla. There was a lot of attention placed on something that literally would have been cured in the matter of 5 minutes if the ethics board or the IG or whomever that was so worried about it would have just communicated and asked me to do that.
Because you did say at the time, I categorically deny that I've committed any breach of the city's ethics code.
110%. I still stand by that statement.
So you stand by that statement.
110%.
So let's move to the broader issue of the ethical standards that public officials and people who are elected to serve the citizens of the city should be held to. How do you see those ethical standards? How do you define them for yourself? And what do you think you and the rest of the people who are in elected office should adhere to?
I think ultimately, if there's any notice of conflict of interest, whether it be an entity that you're associated with or whether it be an entity that has supported you or provided things to you, I think that that is critical that it's publicly disclosed. I think that we've had a myriad different of examples in Baltimore City where, frankly, folks have had challenges up on that. And I think that that has created apathy towards like government. I think that's hurt trust in government. And that's why I was a little concerned about this process, because it was like, you know, the setting up of like this big I got you of, you know, someone who's president of the city council, someone who's chairman of the Board of Estimates, receiving money for this personal benefit associated with a legal defense fund from folks that were doing city with the business with the city. And that couldn't be further from the case. And again, you know, as it relates to, you know, carrying this, if this is the first time it's ever been done, you know, typically the process is somebody like the ethics board, which is say, hey, council president, well, you know, we do find some issue with this. We want you to disclose it. And moving forward, we're going to require and tell everyone to disclose it. We're going to put that in our administrative procedural documents associated with how this handled, because that changed after me, to add in the word trust. And we also would like you to write this letter. And again, it wouldn't have taken me 2 seconds to do that. And we didn't need the 50 media hits on it. We didn't need to go to circuit court. We didn't do all this. But I had to fight to ensure that I wouldn't be sitting here today and you would say, well, you were found guilty by the ethics board for taking money from contractors that are considered donors. So that's why I fought the whole way through and ultimately was successful in winning it in circuit court.
But you can understand why people would, you know, whether or not you think the media covered this correctly or not.
I didn't disparage the media. I didn't say they didn't cover it. I said that we would need that coverage if they would have provided me the opportunity to say, hey, Council President, we want you to put this on your disclosure. We're going to change the word trust in, you know, what we consider for folks to fill us out moving forward. And we would like you to write this letter to tell this entity to do X, Y,
Z. Yeah, but again, you could have done that on your own. You didn't.
I didn't know to do that. I think the reason that they changed
transparency about you know, having to have a legal defense fund was, you know, troubling to a lot of people.
I don't understand why.
Well, because, you know, we don't like to see our public officials being, you know, subjects of federal investigations.
Well, so I would say that it's a lot that adds into that. So I think the type of elected official that I've been, and I think the type of elected official that my ex-wife was, you know, she came under a lot of scrutiny, a lot of attacks. And when you look at the amount of lawsuits, when you look at the amount of times that we've had to have legal coverage, you know, that starts to really, really add up. And that's the stuff that, like, you won't see, maybe the media doesn't see, or the average person doesn't see. Definitely my wife and my daughters had the ability of sitting there and going through that. Mm-hmm. So when something like the federal government that has unlimited resources and unlimited time to literally flip your life over and kind of scrutinize every single penny that you've spent in the past 7 years, which they did. And they ultimately came up with this ruling that my ex-wife shouldn't have access to her own money. Then you need help. And we just didn't have, you know, $1.5 million to just kind of stand up and advocate for ourselves. So I think most people kind of understand that. When you kind of explain it that way, if you've never gone through that process, you don't really understand. If you didn't see like all the lawsuits from my wife being sued over robocalls to her being sued and her license almost taken away from ex-employees and just, you know, the constant amount of time that she personally spent in court and having dozens of lawyers mm-hmm. for different entities. That's just what happens. I think that just comes with
but the way, you know, when you explain it as this was an issue of your former wife having access to her own money, that's not what the government was alleging.
I think it's important for us not to. I mean, that case is still going through the system. I think it's important for us not to speak on it. I'm not her attorney. I can't speak on it. I don't want to speak for her or for her attorney. Mm-hmm. I think it's really important that we kind of focus on me right now, running for city council president, the job I've done, how I've done it, and how we move forward.
And I couldn't agree more. But when it comes to your personal financial situation, and we've talked about this over the years, is your personal financial situation something that voters should be concerned about in terms of how it may affect your approach to your job? What is, when it comes to transparency, when it comes to being open and honest and direct, there have been, you know, many occasions where you have not been honest at all about, you know, the situations in your own personal financial matters, particularly having to do with the lien that the IRS put on your house. And this came out at trial. You testified, it seems to be completely and honestly about what was going on. Should that matter to voters that you were giving them information, whether it was to the press, it was to me, it was to other people, that wasn't true? Should that matter to voters?
So I think it's really important, if we're going to focus on this, that we kind of unpackage that. So I didn't give you untrue information. When I came on your show and you asked me about the lien, I said there is no lien. Because, again, if you follow the transcript in court, and I stand by it, a myriad of different tax attorneys.
We have a little clip of that. Let's play, because that's exactly what you said. This is what you said back in April of 2021.
That I didn't have a lien. That's what I just said.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So yeah, let's listen.
The question you stated was that there was a lien on the property in Reservoir Hill, and you said that you lived in the same neighborhood. And I said, Tom, there's never been a lien on my property.
There's never been a lien on your property.
That's what I just said, yeah.
And you're still contending that that's true?
No, that's not accurate, Tom. You got to listen. Just take 1 second and listen. That's why I wanted to unpackage for you. So what I said was, when I was on your show, I didn't think that there was a lien on my property. And what I was saying before you cut me off is that a myriad of different tax attorneys had looked through the system, had tried to find this lien that this reporter, who was literally a stalker and was extremely obsessed with my wife, had communicated to us. At that point, that's all we knew about this lien. No attorney
but
could
find... But at the trial, with all due respect, Mr. Council President, at the trial, the agent for the IRS... testified that they sent multiple letters to your home informing you about the lien.
That's what they said. Obviously, they didn't prove it. Obviously, that was a charge that she wasn't convicted on. I can't speak to what they say that they've done. Through this experience, I've learned a lot what they say that they've done and what has taken place. All I can say is, at the time, I did not think that there was a lien on the property. That's why I communicated that to you. There's no other way to kind of cut that.
How is it that you didn't know? I mean, if there's a lien for $45,000 on your property, it just seems,
well, one,
it
it's in the middle,
unbelievable that,
that's
that
fine.
No one
it's in the
would
middle,
know.
I so mean, one, it's in the middle of COVID, right? The world is literally shut down. I think we can look through records of looking at like the U.S. Postal Mail system at the time. We can look at records of the IRS. I don't think that that was a normal time in anybody else's life. I would also say, as a person that fought to ensure that we were disaggregating data at the state level to really find out why folks were and where folks were getting the coronavirus at the time and dying at the time, I led that fight. I was aggressively and extremely focused on that. And, you know, at the time, my ex-wife was focused on ensuring that we were releasing prisoners to not subject them to, you know, the additional uncruel treatment associated with COVID and where it was. So
have you ever been untruthful talking about the liens?
Have I ever been untruthful talking about to my wife? Yes. And that's what I communicated.
And to the public, to the press?
So the only thing that you can say about the press is one of my first press conferences before I was sworn in. The press asked me, well, what about the IRS bill or whatever? And I said, it's been taken care of. Now, I had gotten a loan, I gotten approved to
So that
to,
seemed
to
indicate
off.
That you knew that something was out there.
Well, we knew it was out there. I already knew that.
So
I
you
owed,
knew
to,
there
I knew
was
I owed
a, there
the
were,
IRS.
So you did know there was a lien. You
no,
knew
no.
you
No, I and the IRS and haven't. So first of all, it's not typical for someone to have a lien on their property for such a small amount. Particularly with the level of history that I had with the IRS, meaning I've always paid my taxes on time. I've always filed my taxes throughout this entire period. I never didn't file my taxes. And I was responsive in communicating to the IRS the entire time. I mean, if you also go through the transcripts, you'll be able to kind of see that as well. So this is a very unique case that that what took place. I can't tell you why. I can't tell you motivation. I can't tell you happenstance, but I can just lay it out as a reality. Every single lawyer that I've had has been completely blown away by that. But be that as it is, all I can tell you is that when I came on your show and I communicated that to you, that's what I thought. I thought it was an overzealous, very obsessed, agitating reporter because who has lied, who's lied to my wife and tried to put her in certain situations before.
But on that show, when you were here, I mean, while
he posted it on
while
Twitter,
Justin Fenton was,
you said his name, I didn't.
Yeah, he's now with the Baltimore Banner. He's with the Baltimore Sun prior to that.
He posted it. That's the first time
he
I saw.
He posted
it.
A
picture. He had it. Yeah, he was. And if you notice that that picture, the reason that it was so hard for folks to find it, it was the way that our names were spelled. It was spelled as a file, and I think they had a unique symbol of and some spaces in between. So when folks went to kind of look for it, for some reason, he was the only person able to find it at that time. And he had it at that time for a couple months, I don't know, 6 months or 5 months. So that is where I saw it for the first time while I'm on your show, and it's on Twitter.
What about that incident? What about the lack of knowledge about the lien that you contend now? What about openness and transparency about that, either to your wife or to the public? I mean, it's not a crime to tell, you know, to say something that's untrue to the press. It is a crime to say something untrue in court when you're under oath.
Totally.
Because they asked you, because I read the transcript of the trial in which you were asked, why are you telling the truth now and you didn't tell the truth before? And you said, well, I'm under oath.
Well, the truth before wasn't to the government. The truth before was to my wife. So you have to put it in context.
Is there any part of that that you're sorry for?
Oh, totally. I mean, I think, one, it's a very personal situation. So when you asked me, or maybe when the press asked me, I should have led with that this is a personal matter that I'm handling with my wife, I'm handling with my family. And do I have regrets? Definitely. Is it an opportunity for growth? Totally. Not just as a leader, but as a father, as a husband. I mean, look, you know, I tell folks all the time, I grew up in a 3-bedroom house in Northeast Baltimore with 6 women. I was man of my house from one day old, right? And there was times and situations that occurred that I didn't have the resources, or I didn't have the muscle or the strength to be there for the family like I thought a man needed to be. And I always couldn't wait to grow up and be that for my family. So the idea that now this is on public display, that, you know, something that because I, you know, ran for mayor, didn't win, didn't have necessarily the right game plan coming out of it, and I got behind on some of my bills and this issue with the taxes, which, again, is almost 10 years ago at this point now that we're talking about. You know, it's deeply regrettable. Obviously, you think it's something that's personal that kind of remains inside your household. But when you're a public official my wife was put under this microscope and this level of scrutiny and ultimately charged and convicted for what she was convicted for, you know, it comes to fold. So I have to live with that. And I'm living with that. I think what's really important for the voters and really important for the city of Baltimore is the city knows exactly who I am. You know, I'm Nick, who's went through Baltimore City public school system. I'm Nick, who's the first person to go to his college and his family. I'm Nick, who returned back to Baltimore, bought a vacant property in West Baltimore on a block that many people wouldn't buy. I'm Nick that went after my dreams of not being an electrical engineer and doing that to support my family, but then switching over and becoming an elected official, giving up a lot of money and a lot of access and a lot of resources to really pour into the city and create other folks like me when I saw my friends drop behind. So I think that is what sets me apart, and that's what I'll continue to stand for. And I think the biggest thing of what I've learned coming out of this is just really being that role model and that example for my daughters, because they've had a front row in watching all of this unfold.
Baltimore City Council President Nick Mosby is my guest. He's with me here in Studio A as part of our Conversations with the Candidates series. Mr. Mosby is the incumbent and a candidate for City Council President in the Democratic primary in May. You are welcome to join us when we come back from a quick break. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is Baltimore's NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.
I'm Al Waller.
I'm Catherine Collinson.
And I'm Mihaela Vince.
In upcoming episodes of Clear Path, Your Roadmap for Life, we'll discuss ways to catch up on retirement savings and the importance of self-care. Tune in to WYPR's website and mobile app, all major podcast platforms, and transamericainstitute.org.
And Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, our series of conversations with the candidates continues with Takesha Martinez. She's the mayor of Hagerstown and one of 16 candidates in the Democratic primary to succeed Representative David Trone in Congress in District 6. Will her ties to Western Maryland be enough to distinguish her in that large field? Takesha Martinez will make the case for her candidacy tomorrow on Midday. And if you just joined us today, my guest is Baltimore City Council President Nick Mosby, who's running in the Democratic primary for a second term. His main opponents in that race are Councilman Zeke Cohen and former City Councilwoman Shannon Sneed. You are welcome to join us. Our number is 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. And Mr. Council President, we have a caller, Karen, who's on the line in Baltimore. Welcome to Midday with Council President.
Hi. I just wanted to point out something that's bothered me for a long time with politics in our country. And I think Baltimore has the same problem that we see all over the country. And that is, when there are issues with black people and black politicians in the political sphere, we go after them with a magnitude of vehemence that we don't do with white politicians and white people in the political sphere. And I am a white woman. It really disturbs me. Marilyn Mosby, what she did compared to like Donald Trump and his level of fraud and how long it took to bring his fraud to the level when pretty much everybody knew it was going on, really bothers me. And Catherine Pugh, I was not a fan of Catherine, but nonetheless, she got picked out and vilified much more so than any of the other people that were involved in her case with what went on that board of directors. And they were all white men. And I'm not calling so much because I'm trying to say that I'm a big fan of Mr. Mosby's. I really did like Marilyn as the Attorney General, but I just really find that aspect of our politics in this country distressing. And it reminds me, I'll say one more thing. It reminds me of...
Well, I'm sorry, we don't have time to continue that comment, but Mr. Council President, is there racial animus behind the investigation into you and your wife? I mean, you were, during the course of the trial, it came to light that the prosecutors said that in 2014 and 2015, you exaggerated the number of charitable donations you made. That's cheating on taxes. Do you expect to be indicted for that behavior?
Absolutely not. Like I said, you know, with this process, they literally flip your life upside down and go through it with a fine-tooth comb. I think that, you know, no one would want to go through what we've gone through, what my children have gone through.
No, you're absolutely right.
Whether the federal government has had political animus or targeted black elected officials that speak up on black issues, I'm not skillful enough to be able to kind of either, you know, articulate any of that or kind of explain or justify it. I don't know.
Because, you know,
should talk to maybe someone that works in the area. But all I can say is, as an elected official, I've always stood up for the right reasons. I've always done it with a certain level of integrity and dignity, and I'll continue to do so. I can say, by being that close and watching my wife do her job, my ex-wife, she did the same thing. So I can't speak on why they decided to do what they did. I can't speak on why the charges were they were charged with. I can't. That you would have to.
Because one of the charges, one of the ones in which your former wife was found guilty, was something you were involved in. It had to do with this gift letter, where you needed to make it look like you had lent your wife, your former wife.
No, it's I wouldn't say make it look like. So it was a joint account that we had with $5,000.
She said she took it out. You gave her the money, but in fact, it was from hers.
One second, Tom. So do you have more questions, or I want to answer the first question?
You can answer that one.
Okay, so I think it's important to note that it was a joint account that we had. It was $5,000 of the money that we had in an account. She took out, put it in her main bank account. Her bank ultimately told her she couldn't put the money in that way, and she needed to get it from another source. So I had the $5,000 available to give to her, but she didn't have another bank account to put it back in. She had to take out of that bank account, and I put it in my bank account. And ultimately, she was convicted for our money, her money, that she used to purchase a property with. Yes, that's accurate.
So you were, you're contending you were unfairly convicted on that.
I've never said that. So I think it's important. I think it's important, particularly if we're talking about
this.
I think it's important, Tom, particularly since we're talking about this and the case is still going on, that you not put any additional words in my mouth about it. I never said unfairly. I simply stated what took place.
What is your current personal financial condition, and is that something that should be of concern to voters who are considering, you know, continuing your term as or your work as city council president?
That no, that should not be factored as my.
I mean,
term.
there are people who are turned down for jobs because they're in debt. There are people who
so
aren't
that's
given
part of the
security.
Requirement. If there's a requirement for me and all of my. Colleagues to do that, I'll participate like I always participate in anything else.
Will you still run your consulting business?
I don't have a consulting business, Tom.
Did you ever have a consulting business?
For a year, back in 2016. Again, we're talking about almost 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm. So that's you're not going to do that?
I don't have that currently, no.
Okay. Your wages had been garnished because of, you were behind on car payments, student loans, the mortgage.
So I ran for mayor. I think we already talked about this. We can talk about this and spend the time on the show. I would like to maybe come back and talk about the campaign and talk about what I'm going to do. But we can go down this line of question as much as you want.
People know Nick Mosby, this is now what they're hearing about Nick Mosby, and I want to give you an opportunity misconceptions that you
different.
Think they might have.
I think it's a little different. I say when I say that, and I like to answer the question, but you just put in another a statement. When I say folks know Nick Mosby, I say they know my integrity. They know my heart. They know that the reality is sometimes we have situations that come up in our life and we have to address them, right? I don't have a mother or father to lean on. I don't have grandparents to lean on. I've built what I have by myself. I was the patriarch of my family for quite some time at a very young age, right? And the lessons that I've learned, I don't shy away from. I'm not ashamed of. I've actually grown from this process because I think this story is more like so many other folks. They just happen not to be public officials that have to kind of communicate it in a way that I've communicated. So I'm not ashamed that, I was 2 months behind on a car payment. If folks want to know that at age 30, whatever, that took place, great, right? Came out in court, I'm okay with that, right? Or that I was 2 months behind on mortgage. I think with the bigger context of the story is you had this young man who had this idea of changing his city in a way that I thought the city wasn't moving in, and I ran for mayor. And I gave up my lucrative job as an electrical engineer and focused on that full time. And I didn't handle that the right way. I didn't handle it the right way as it relates to setting it up, nor did I handle it the right way as it relates to communicating to my wife what I was going through at the time, because I wanted to be the man. I wanted to ensure that I was still taking care of all the responsibilities that I have always taken on in my house. So again, I'm not ashamed of it. It's the reality. It's the story. I think when I say people know me, that story is probably more common that kind of comes across in the questioning or comes across through this debate. And I think that is what people approach me with, like on a regular basis when they approach me on the street. Now, I think going back to, I guess, what you were talking about before, do you want to talk about that again in detail?
Sure.
Which topic was that?
Well, I mean, I'm just talking about people's understanding, people perhaps needing clarification.
That's why I'm willing to do this. I mean, right after the court case, I went on television stations, I went on radio shows, I communicated, I've talked about this openly when I go to community meetings. So this is not an issue that I've shied away from as it relates to the proceedings in court.
Yeah, and we appreciate your being here today. I have a friend, a preacher, a black preacher, who has a question, who says, as an African-American male, who serves with an African-American male mayor and a male state's attorney and a male comptroller of a predominantly African-American city, how do you feel that this has been beneficial to the majority-minority community? It's a majority black city, obviously. Speak to the potential influence one would expect it to have on the future of our young people.
Well, I mean, I think that when, I grew up wanting to be in politics because I saw... It was kind of like a microcosm of 2008 when Mayor Kurt Schmoke was elected as mayor. And I saw the hope, in my mother and my community and school. So I think that, you can't discredit the visible representation of the leadership that kind of counters what we see every single day when we open up a newspaper, when we turn on the news, when we look at the content that's being produced in Hollywood and New York about cities like Baltimore. I think for our young folks to see the positive imagery of folks that are leading their city with integrity, that care about them and are pushing for policies for them is critically important, you know, as we relate to the reality is if you go speak to a squeegee boy, it's probably going to be a different tone and discourse, particularly initially, than if I decided to do so. I think when they look in my eyes, they can potentially see themselves. So that imagery and what he laid out to in the symbolic representation of what the pastor was talking about, I think speaks volumes to where we are as a city and how we need to continue to move forward.
All right, we'll talk about some of the issues with the city council when we come back from on the other side of a quick break. Baltimore City Council President Nick Mosby is my guest. He's a candidate for a second term as city council president in the Democratic primary in May. We'll have more with Council President Mosby. You can join our conversation at 410-662-8780. You can email us midday@wipr.org. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is Baltimore's NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, it's the latest installment in our series of conversations with the candidates. My guest today is Baltimore City Council President Nick Mosby. He's the incumbent running for re-election in the Democratic primary. First District City Councilman Zeke Cohen and Shannon Sneed, a former city councilwoman who ran for the office unsuccessfully in 2020, are also running, as is a lesser-known candidate, Emmanuel Digman. You are welcome to join our conversation with Nick Mosby, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org. Let's go to the phones to Eduardo, who's on the line from Baltimore. Welcome to the show with Council President Mosby.
Thank you very much for your time. Thank you, Mr. Hall. I'm sitting here in the doctor's office, and I listen to Mr. Mosley. I have a question for you, sir. You've been part of City Hall for close to a decade, and you just telling us that you like another chance to, you know, another term to change things in the city. But what are you going to do different that you say you haven't been able to do in a decade? It's just, you know, why should we give you another chance? And I'll get myself out of the line. Thank you very much for your time.
Yes, sir. Eduardo, I think that's an excellent question. And I think that that's where, you know, I really want to kind of focus on, you know, when we talk about the campaign is my experience and what I've done in comparison to my opponents. Both of my opponents have served in City Hall as well. But I mean, when you look at my experience, whether, you know, before it was sexy to talk about second chances, passing ban the box, one of the most progressive rehiring hiring policies for formerly incarcerated folks in the entire country, that was my bill that I was able to really push out there. When we talk about you know, saving the Preakness and ensuring that the Preakness stayed in Baltimore and the economic impact and what that would have meant to Park Heights, who it's already has not seen the level of investment from a federal, state, or city perspective in quite some time, and saving that there, you know, my fight leading that is great. Open up $18 million in scholarship funding from the state to GED recipients, you know, that was my bill. Ensuring that we go away with the draconian policy of taking folks' homes, you know, elderly women's homes for a water bill. I fought that in a state and ultimately was able to get that passed. So Baltimore City no longer allowed for folks that owed just $1,000 or whatever in water bills to have their property taken away that's been in their family for generations. When we fast forward to today, you know, local control, returning it back to the City Hall and citizens of Baltimore, the only jurisdiction in the state that didn't have it since the Civil War.
That process isn't quite complete yet, is it?
It's completed. We have some cleanup language in Annapolis, but it goes to the voters. The voters have overwhelmingly said that they want it in November, and it will be completely done. I mean, right now, the city council can push out policy to do local control. When we talk about, you know, mental illness during COVID, when we talk about housing insecurity or food insecurity, when we talk about the way the Board of Estimates has run, when we talk about professionalizing the council, really just looking at bills from a fiscal impact perspective and really doing substantive legislation as opposed opposed to just non-binding resolutions. Again, I think that and many other things that come kind of in between is my experience, and talks about how we want to continue to move the city forward. The last thing I'll say about that process is, you know, this is the first council that's had the ability to not only cut from the administration's budget, but also redirect spending and redirecting it in ways of CTE, vocational training for our young folks by setting up the Dante Barksdale apprenticeship program and $1 million there. When we talk about now having after school middle school sports citywide, particularly as it relates to our girls who were at a huge competitive disadvantage, that had to literally wait for organized sports until they got to high school, that no longer being the case, and working with the school system, ensuring that they put money into a budget there that was $2 million last year. I hope to do more this year too. All the other things, from redirecting spending for apparatus for our fire department to fixing up facilities for our DPW workers, to ensuring that we put more City Watch cameras out there from a public safety perspective, and we put money in funding for our residents to go after and get doorbell cameras to help public safety. You know, all those things I've been able to do. And again, I think when you put my record up against anybody else's in this race, it is not comparable, to say the least. And that's why I'm running again, Eduardo, because I'm asking the citizens to allow me to continue to do this work. You know, I'm thankful for the opportunity to serve the city of Baltimore.
So those are some of the things you're proud of in terms of accomplishments, not just when you're a council president, but even before you were elected to that office. What about some of the things that have not gone your way? The Dollar House program that you suggested a couple of years ago. The Neighborhood Assistance Corporation of America came and got involved in a very contentious city hall debate and a little fracas. Folks said that as a legislative act, it was not handled well. You didn't have the buy-in from the housing advocacy community. You didn't have enough buy-in from folks. I mean, what have you learned from those kinds of things? That and the renter's insurance, the deposit insurance bill that you had championed for a while. I mean, we all try things that don't work out, and we try to learn from them. What have you learned from those particular bills?
So, you know, I think a lot of different things. One, I was new to being a president. So, you know, when I came and I reconfigured the council, and there's 15 members on the council, but there was 14 working committees. Just as a comparison, in Annapolis, we have 141 members of the House of Delegates, and we have 6 working committees. So literally Baltimore City was set up in a way to just give everyone the chairmanship, as kind of good deed, but it wasn't structured in a way that made sense. I mean, we had an education committee, but we don't do education policy. All education policy for the state is done in Annapolis, right? So, when I came in, I said, let's not have committees where we have just 3 members and 2 members can literally vote something out and put it on the floor, but let's have more discourse. Let's have members of at least 5 or 7 members in a committee, so we have more of the vote and more of the say from the city doing that dialogue and that discourse, doing the really important work, which is the committee work. I never knew that, folks would look at that in a way like, oh, you're changing. Change is hard. And the way that Baltimore City Council was functioning prior to me being president, they had major, major concerns and issues just from a legislative perspective. And I think that is, again, my advantage of working in Annapolis and bringing some of that back to City Hall. So when we talk about that, in the past, we've always looked at the city council as kind of, I call my city councilman because I have this pothole, or it's this drug corner right here, or I need this house boarded up, or the grass is growing too high. That's constituent services. We're the conduit to that, and that's perfect. That is our job. But another huge piece of the legislative body of the city of Baltimore, which is called the city council, is to actually put in substantive legislation. And that wasn't happening. The administration, the mayor was creating legislation and assigning it to council members, and they were putting it in. Or the council members were just doing a lot of non-binding resolutions that aren't ordinances that really go after the systemic issues that change. So when we talk about some of the really large bills, like the House Baltimore bill, which I'm glad you brought up, that's something that was new to the city, of the legislative body solely coming up with it. And I'm going to be honest, the administration fought us tooth and nail on trying not to do it, which is interesting because today, through a process that doesn't go through the board of, that doesn't go through the city council, but went through the board of estimates, and the mayor controls 3 out of 5 seats, is the fixed pricing model, which is the Dollar House program. But it doesn't come with any of the ARPA money. It doesn't come with any prioritization of affordable home ownership for our working class folks, our paraprofessionals, our teachers, our bus drivers, our folks in DPW, DOT, to put them in the front of the line. Because as we know, as the interest rates will start to come down, affordability of home ownership will lessen and lessen more and more, particularly in cities like Baltimore, which are a hotbed. There is no affordability associated with folks that are buying these properties to ensure that the folks that they bring in to stabilize these blocks by renting them, these blocks, as those blocks continue to stabilize, that their rents don't go exorbitant levels where they no longer can afford and they're displaced. So there's no displacement aspect of this. There's no funding. There's no specific requirements of local hiring for local contractors to do the work on the houses while we're fixed. So all the things that were built in the Dollar House program that we presented, I still stand by it. I'm still excited about it. That's why I voted against the fixed pricing on the Board of Estimates today. But I think change is hard, right? And, you know, through this first term of change, a significant change of not only being able to cut from the budget, but also redirect spending, but also change of really driving substantive legislation and not, you know, having, 10 folks, you know, in every single district, you know, going to bat mitzvahs and birthday parties and cookouts, but really bringing folks inside of City Hall and having real policy analysts and folks that are really scrutinizing the budget that we have never had before. I mean, we've never had review of revenue confirmation until this term. We've never had the level of budgetary questioning in the creation of finance in the performance committee until this council. And again, that's why I stand on this work, and that's why Eduardo, I'm happy for that question.
And we're short on time. Just last couple minutes here. Harbor Place. There are a lot of folks who think that the council is fast tracking the idea of David Bramble and MCB Real Estate to do his particular plan for Harbor Place.
I mean, this is another issue that, you know, I think is great. One, you know, ton of communication through the mayor's office, through the council member of the district, through the developer, in kind of laying out where we were going to go.
Do you think the Bramble plan is where we should go?
I think the citizens get to vote on it. I think that's the key with this. This is not something that the council decided. This is something that the city of Baltimore and the residents ultimately get to decide if they want
this development
or not.
The council's deciding the zoning, though, isn't it?
Yeah, to allow for it to get on and for voters to vote. So the voters will know exactly what they're getting when they vote in November. I think that's the key about this. Having this process where it had to go through the voters is critically important.
ARPA funding. You mentioned to me during the break that you voted against ARPA funding again today. You've voted for it. I voted against it every time it's come up. It's a use it or lose it proposition. Is the city handling the ARPA funding in the best way?
I think that question is probably better for the mayor's office of recovery or the mayor himself, the plan that they have in place. The fact that the council, because of our charter and the way everything was set up, has nothing to do with kind of the way the money should be spent. You know, I constantly publicly and privately talked about the fact that we should really go after and tackle generational challenges, infrastructure in communities that have been disproportionately disinvested in for decades, ensuring that we have opportunities for our legacy renters to become homeowners through affordable home ownership opportunities and rebuild East and West Baltimore up in a way that we haven't seen in quite some time. It creates jobs. It creates new hope. It creates new energy and revenue sources for the city. Ultimately, the administration decided to carve out the money and not have a concentrated focus on one or two things, but really, divvy the money out, and dissipate it to this organization and that organization and, ultimately their plan. And because we're not part of that and I have no say-so, I didn't think that it was in my best interest to vote for organizations and groups that were receiving $250,000, $500,000, $2 million, and I not have any relationship or understanding or knowing the benefit. The last thing I'll say is it's really about return on investment, and that's what I constantly talked about. We have, we look at $641 million is this huge pot of money, but when you really talk about the challenges of a city of Baltimore, it really streamlines it and brings it down. So it's like, what were the goals? What are the objectives? What are the key performance indicators that we were going to set for? So in 5, 10, 15 years, we can look back at that opportunity and know that we did the right thing.
All right, and that's all the time we have for today. Nick Mosby, he's the incumbent Democrat running for Baltimore City Council President. Thank you for your time, sir. I appreciate it. Tomorrow, our series of conversations with the candidates continues with the mayor of Hagerstown, Takesha Martinez. She's a candidate in the 6th District primary, Democratic primary for Congress. She'll join me for the hour tomorrow on Midday. I want to thank Fern Shen and Mark Reuter from Baltimore Brew, Emily Opilo from the Baltimore Sun, Emily Sullivan and Justin Fenton from the Baltimore Banner, and the WIPR News Department for their help with today's show. That's who I read to figure out what's going on. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. Have a great day.
This is Baltimore's NPR News Station, 88.1 WIPR.